Thank you for the powerful way you participated in the singing tonight, and especially that song. It's a perfect introduction to my lesson this evening. As you can see on the screen before you, it's part of the title of the lesson. And the subtitle is this: Is it reasonable to believe in God in this enlightened age, this age of science? And I can tell you there are a host of folks who would answer that question in the negative. They would say to you that the more we've learned about the natural world, the less is the need for belief in God. That for most folks in the ancient times, the reason they posited God is because of their ignorance. And as we've learned how, in the fact, the natural world is capable of producing and sustaining itself, the need for God has decreased. So that's my question to you tonight. We live in a culture that's been impacted for the last 160 years by a theory that was first proposed and given scientific credibility in 1859 by Charles Darwin. It has come to be accepted as the worldview that is most reasonable by academia. The view that all living things on the earth, and in fact the universe itself, arose by natural causes without the necessity of an intelligent designer whatsoever. And I must tell you that in that environment, I am considered on the par of a dinosaur. In fact, I've given lectures like this on many college campuses, and I've had students and professors tell me they came to hear me because they wanted to see a dinosaur. Someone who had a college education, even from some rather prestigious schools, who still believed in creation. It's a rarity in academia. The song we just sang was written by Brother A.W. Dicus. He has some special meaning to me because he was the dean of the college when I was a student at Florida Christian College, as it was named in those days, back in the 1960s. And he was a highly respected physicist. In fact, you use one of his patents every day if you drive a car, because he was the inventor of the turn signal in your car as one of his many inventions. And he was highly respected as a physicist, which he taught for our school. He wrote this song in the 1960s. And I'm convinced, though I never did ask him specifically, that he wrote it because we were at a peak in the God is Dead movement in the United States during the 1960s. Some of you are old enough to remember that. Please nod your heads. You'll make me feel better. This was not a new idea, because the God is Dead concept has rather ancient pedigree. Nietzsche talked about it in the 1800s. But in Time magazine on April the 8th, 1966, this was the headline: Is God Dead? And had you read that magazine, you would find inside it some references to quotes from Thomas J.J. Altizer and William Hamilton in their book Radical Theology and the Death of God. And they went something like this: We must realize that the death of God is an historical event, that God has died in our cosmos, in our history. The dead God is the God of the historic Christian church and beyond the church of Christendom at large. I remind you, if you knew it already, and I'll tell you for the first time if you didn't, Altizer and Hamilton are theologians. And here they are, theologians proclaiming the death of God and saying, we killed him. And of course, the other side of that story is that means they believe we made him up in the first place and that he was a response to mankind, not an independent entity that truly exists. So has God died in our time, in our cosmos, the God of Christendom? That certainly was the proposal in the 1960s by lots of theologians. So I tell you again this evening, you should not simply accept what preachers say from pulpits. They say a lot of very stupid things, things that need to be questioned. I don't want you to accept what I say tonight either. I want you to challenge what I say with your own intelligence and with your examination of the scriptures and of the natural world. So, A.W. Dicus wrote a song that said, "Our God, He is alive," in the 1960s. And I thank God for him. Here's some other brazen things that have been said in recent days. This by Richard Dawkins in 2007 in the New York Times. It's absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, and I pause right there to tell you, he means by that the general theory of evolution that all living things came about by natural causes without the necessity of an intelligent designer whatsoever. So I will raise my hand as one who does not believe in that. And here's what Dawkins says about me and lots of other folks. That person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that. I don't like that. I don't think he would like that if I said that about him. And those kinds of statements are not helpful in the discussion, wouldn't you agree? In contrast, here is a statement from Professor Anthony Flew, Doctor of Philosophy, for many, many years, an avowed atheist who debated creationists and belittled their belief. And in his 80th year, in 2004, Professor Flew, a champion for evolution and atheism, made this statement. "It now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design." Dr. Flew, at 80 years old, finally had to admit, "I cannot explain this without somebody having designed this." I don't know how you feel about that, but I appreciate an 80-year-old man that'll change his mind. And he changed it based on the evidence of the natural world. Now, did he become a believer in the Bible? No, sir. But he at least came to be convicted there has to be something grand and glorious that designed this. I'm absolutely convicted of the same thing. Now, since we're having this discussion, ladies and gentlemen, in a church building, I always like to take a moment to turn to the Scriptures. So we're going to look first at Psalm 19, a famous passage from the Old Testament that says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone throughout all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." So the ancient writer of the Psalms said, you look to the heavens and they declare the glory of God. What he's arguing, folks, is that the natural world gives a testimony to the existence of God. Romans, the first chapter, verse 20. Of all the passages in the Bible, I think this one is the clearest with regard to the argument we're going to be making this evening. Romans 1 verse 20 says, "For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." That, ladies and gentlemen, is the biblical expression of the argument from design. How can you see something that's invisible? The passage says, "Since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen." How do you see something invisible? God is not amenable to direct observation. So how do you know there is a God? This passage says, "By examining the things that are made." So here's the argument. If there's something in the natural world that has all the earmarks of being designed, that argues that something designed it. And that's something the Bible calls God. Now this passage says His invisible attributes can be understood, and those attributes are His eternal power. Whoever this God is, He must be eternally, magnificently powerful. And secondly, he must be divine. He must be something beyond the natural world. And this passage argues both of those things can be determined by looking at God's other book. So for the rest of our time this evening, I hope nobody takes offense. Even though this lecture is taking place inside a church building, if I close this book, which is a book of Revelation, and I'm firmly convinced it's the Word of God, but it is not to this book I'm turning this evening. It's to God's other book. For I'm convinced he gives grand testimony in the book of the natural world for his existence. And by the way, this book makes the same kind of argument. So we turn our attention from the revelation to God's revelation in his other book for the rest of our time this evening. So here's my question. And you understand that to do this properly, we need about 6 months. And we got one lecture. So obviously, I had to be very selective on what we'll talk about tonight. And I've chosen a particular approach. There are lots of other approaches we could take. But I like this one. If you were going to try to be convinced that there's intelligent life out there in the universe somewhere, what would it take? You do know we're looking for it, right? In fact, our government is spending millions of dollars to look for it. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence has been going on for a long, long time. When I was a student at Harvard University, SETI was being supported by your tax dollars in the 1960s. And my professor in astronomy at Harvard was right in the middle of it. And if I had the time, I'd tell you a nice long story about what happened in the spring of 1968. But the fact is, SETI was looking, and still is, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. For short, looking for ETs. I understand the movie ET is coming back. Some of us are old enough to remember when it came out the first place. There are lots of people that believe there are ETs out there. My question to you is, what kind of evidence would it take for you to convince you that there are such things? And could you use the methods of science to get at that? Well, certainly the SETI organization believes you can. And they're still doing it to this day, even though your tax money has not been used to fund them for a long time. You know why? Because they never found the first scintilla of evidence that there is an ET out there. But they're still looking. In fact, they have a website. There it is. You can go look it up for yourself after this lecture tonight if you're interested. And here's a quote from the first paragraph of that website, and I'll read it to you. SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, is an exploratory science that seeks evidence of life in the universe by looking for some signature of its technology. What are they looking for? Some kind of evidence from out there that there's technology out there, because they don't believe nature produces technology. That's what they're looking for. Virtually all radio SETI experiments have looked for what are called narrow band signals. These are radio emissions that are at one spot on your radio dial. On my way driving this evening, I dialed into 7:40 a.m. on my radio dial, and I listened to a bunch of talk going on. You probably did something similar. What these folks are searching for is signals from outer space that are narrow band radio signals that contain information. And here's the reason. Narrow band signals are the mark of a purposely built transmitter. Natural cosmic noisemakers such as pulsars and quasars do not make radio signals this narrow, nor do they contain information. So were they to find such a radio signal, I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that every headline and every newspaper on earth would say, we have found evidence for extraterrestrials. Have they found such a signal? No, they have not. Are they still looking? Yes, they are. My question to you is, if they found such a radio signal, would it be convincing to you that there are ETs out there? I'll leave that for you to figure out. But they conclude that they can infer intelligent cause without necessarily identifying what that intelligence is. And that's precisely what you can do by looking at scientific methodology and concluding intelligent design. Well, since they hadn't found anything, Carl Sagan decided he'd write a book about it. Maybe you've seen this book, Contact, or maybe you've seen the movie. If you're like most folks, you haven't read the book, but you've seen the movie. And may I recommend the book? It's better than the movie, as in most cases. But what was the point of this book that Sagan wrote? Sagan was right in the middle of the SETI program, as was my professor at Harvard. They were searching with all that was in them for radio signals. Well, in this book, you see all those telescopes? Those are radio telescopes. In this book, they actually found a signal from outer space, and everybody concluded somebody out there is trying to tell us something. And here's the signal they received. Well, that's a little small for you to read, so I've blown it up here. So I'm going to let you look at that for just a minute. You see any intelligence in that? Well, that's because you don't understand it. So I'm going to explain it to you. First of all, you see these ones here? Those stand for little bleeps on the radio telescope. So when you see two little ones there, think of that as bleep, bleep. And then you see the zero next, right there. That zero is a pause. So you have two bleeps and a pause. Let me just forward it here. Two bleeps and a pause. Three bleeps and a pause. Five bleeps and a pause. Seven bleeps and a pause. 11 bleeps and a pause. Please don't make me go through this whole list. 13 is the next one. 17 is the next one. 19 is the next one. All right, I'm going to have to give you the answer here. Those are the prime numbers. Now, you remember your math, right, class? Prime numbers are numbers that are divisible only by themselves and one. You can't divide anything else into them. And what you have in this chart is the first 25 prime numbers in a row. And according to Contact, that's the signal they got from a specific point in outer space on radio signals. Now, do you think, ladies and gentlemen, that the stars can bleep out the first 25 prime numbers in order? Nobody believes that. In fact, in Carl Sagan's book on intelligent life in the universe, one of the things he says, if we were ever to discover this, we'd have 99% certainty there's intelligence out there. And that's one of them. If you count up the last row of ones down here, starting right here and going all the way down to there, it's 101. That's the 25th prime number. So I'll tell you what everybody concluded in that book, that this sequence containing the first 25 prime numbers came from an intelligent source. Nobody believed nature did that. What if it really happened? It hasn't happened. That's fiction. But what if it really did happen? Well, for me, that would be very powerful evidence there's somebody intelligent out there. Nature doesn't do that. Do you see the reasoning? That's what's important here. Now, what I want to do is apply that same reasoning right here on earth. Look, our search for ETs out there has been totally useless in terms of producing any satisfying results. But I will tell you, the search for intelligent design here on earth has been very fruitful. If we received a message from space that had a language in it that we could decode and read, I will tell you there isn't a person on earth that wouldn't think that came from an intelligent source. Suppose we got a message that says, "We're out here, come and find us." And it was a legitimate radio signal from someplace in space. Well, I want to tell you, there's all kinds of signs for intelligent design right here on Earth, right here under your nose. We don't have to look in outer space. Let's use the same kind of reasoning and apply it to every living cell. Every living cell and every living thing has all kinds of signs of intelligent design. In particular, there's a language in every living cell. Did you know that? And we've learned how to read it. We know exactly what it means. It's utterly incredible, ladies and gentlemen. And not only is there a language in every living cell, that language does things in which the cell produces something as a result of it. And that's going to be my story in the next few minutes. And I'm telling you, if we received the language that's in a cell from a signal from outer space, there wouldn't be one person on earth that didn't think that came from an intelligent source. But with it in every living cell on earth, people say, "Isn't it interesting what nature did?" Research on DNA continues to reveal signs of design everywhere you look. And that's why Anthony Flew said, "I have to go where the evidence leads." And he finally said, "Something had to design this. Nature did not produce this." And I say, amen. So there's DNA. The structure discovered first by Francis Crick and James Watson in 1953. They received the Nobel Prize for this grand discovery. And from that discovery in the 1950s has come a host of information. Ladies and gentlemen, you are blessed to live in the 21st century, because in the last 60 years, we have learned more about how life functions at the microscopic level than in all the history of mankind prior to that time. You are blessed to live in this age, the age of DNA. And what it's done is it's uncovered the secrets of how life functions. And we're learning more every second. DNA has a certain characteristic structure. If you look at it here, it has a couple of strands wrapped around each other. It's a helix with strands wrapped around each other like this. You'll also notice that it has cross pieces that connect it together. And if you were in my chemistry class, ladies and gentlemen, we'd spend about 6 weeks on this, and you'd memorize every single thing about it. Because it's critically important, the chemistry of every piece, because it's how it functions and it's how it maintains information. It's how it's able to copy itself. It's utterly fascinating. It has a double helix with crossbars, and because of that, it has a capacity to reproduce itself. Now, if you start getting sleepy, I'm going to make you stand up. This is chemistry. You stick with me. I don't expect you to understand everything if you're not a chemistry person. It's okay. Here's what I expect you to do. I expect you to get the force of the argument. So stay with me. You see these two strands that are intertwined? The fact is that when DNA gets copied, it unzips, it comes apart. And when it comes apart, it exposes two sides here. And on those two sides, it can then copy the information that's contained there. So the DNA unzips and exposes a side. It actually exposes two sides. It has a particular order of four molecules, A, C, G, and T. You don't need to know that. You don't need to memorize it. But it's adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine. There are exactly four of them. And they make up those cross pieces. And the interesting thing is that two of them always hook up with each other and the other two always hook up with each other. And there's a good reason for that. It's their chemistry, ladies and gentlemen, that allows them to connect. These can be read in sequence. Well, if you look at this particular chart, you'll see purple, kind of a purplish, a yellow, a green, and a blue. The blue always goes with the green. The purple always goes with the yellow. You see that? As you look up and down this strand, that's the way it always is. And what you find out is if you read up that strand, you're reading a sequence of those four molecules in order. And every three letters makes a word. Young people in this audience, wouldn't it be nice to have a language that had only three-letter words? Thee and cat. Well, this language has only three-letter words. And they're made of four different letters, A, C, G, and T. So I ask you, class, let's do a little mathematics here. If you have four letters that you can use, and you can make three-letter words with them. In this first position of the three-letter word, you can use any of the four letters. In the second position, you can use any of the four letters. We allow repeats. And in the third position, you can use any of the four letters. Okay? Four letters taken three at a time. How many words can you make? It's a combination problem. Well, you're not going to answer out loud anyway. But it's 4 times 4 times 4. And if you do the arithmetic in your head real quick, which, by the way, Americans are getting terrible at because we always use calculators or computers. You know what? If I were teaching elementary school today, I wouldn't allow computers until they learn how to do it the hard way. Kids, listen to me. You need to know how to do arithmetic in your head. Quit punching it in calculators till you learn how to do it the hard way. Then you appreciate the mathematics. That was thrown in free of charge. There are exactly 64 words in this language. Four letters taken three at a time. And I happen to have a chart that contains all 64. So I'm going to let you study that for just a minute. And at the end of this lecture, we're having a test on this. This chart is called the genetic code because it is the language contained in DNA that codes for certain things. And I'm going to tell you exactly what it codes for. I'm looking you over real good. Are you still awake? All right, watch. If this is the first letter, by the way, T is replaced by a U in this thing, and I'm not explaining that to you tonight. Suppose this is the first letter, this is the second letter, and this is the third letter in the three-letter word. So then, if you had U as your first letter, U as your second letter, and U as your third letter, the word would be OO. U, U, U. Now, what does that mean? In genetic code, that means fee. UUU means fee. Well, that's helpful, isn't it? You know exactly what that is. No, you don't. What about UUC? That also means fee. UUA means loo. UUG means loo. And what does that mean? Well, I'll tell you what it means. On this chart, you find all the 20 common amino acids that are used in building proteins in every living thing. You didn't get that, so I'm going to say it again. Proteins are important to your body. Would you agree? Proteins are important in every living cell. Proteins are constructed from a chain of amino acids. And in this code, you find a code for all of the common 20 amino acids that make up all proteins in every single living thing. That, ladies and gentlemen, is utterly incredible what I just said to you. Because what I just said is that in every living cell there is a language that codes for specific things. And we know exactly what the language means. And what it means is, here is a specific amino acid. Here's another specific amino acid. Here's another one. And when you put those in a specific order, it makes a protein, ladies and gentlemen. So what you have before you displayed on this screen is one of the most magnificent discoveries we've ever made in the history of mankind. We have found out that in every living thing there is a language that codes for specific things that allows the body to build things. That's incredible. And what scientists have tried to do is to fit that under the umbrella of the evolutionary theory that it says this all came about by natural causes. Folks, that would be comparable to saying a language transmitted by radio signals from outer space came from nature doing it by itself. I don't believe it. It stretches the limits of our imagination. And if I stopped right here tonight and said not one other word, class, that should be sufficient to say there's intelligence behind this. But we haven't even started. We haven't even started to begin to start. There's so much more to the story. So let me explain to you just a little more of what is done with that language. So here we have the DNA, and you notice it's unzipping. And by the way, you see that purple thing right there? That's called RNA polymerase. Anything that ends in A-S-E, folks, is an enzyme. And an enzyme is a protein. You see that purple thing right there? That's what allows the DNA to unzip. And it's a protein. Okay, so now it's unzipped, and you see this order of four letters going up the side here? What's happening now is a copy is being made called messenger RNA that's taking the information off of this side of the chain and copying it onto the messenger RNA, which can then take it somewhere else and do something with it. So, ladies and gentlemen, inside your living cells, not only is there a language, but it's a language that can be transcribed and then taken somewhere else to do something with it. And the information on this transcribed messenger RNA is the exact mirror image of what's on that strand right there. Utterly incredible. And people teach this in biochemistry classes as if there was nothing to this. And they pat themselves on the back for having discovered it. Instead of saying, look at the marvel of this. How did this happen? Oh, this evolved by natural causes over millions of years. It's a fairy tale. Well, there's so much more I need to tell you about that. We simply don't have the time tonight, so I'm going to go on to the next slide, which speaks to what happens next. You see, in order to build a protein, you have to transcribe the information off of the DNA onto the RNA, and then you have to migrate outside the nucleus, and then it has to be translated in a separate place in the cell, and then the protein is built. And here's a picture worth a thousand words. I do a quick summary, and then we're going to show you a little video clip to show it in live action. Up here's the DNA inside the nucleus of the cell. It contains all that information I told you about, and you know it's stored in four letters with three-letter words, right? That information has to be copied or transcribed off of the DNA. That's the messenger RNA. Then it has to be cleaned up and made into processing into a mature messenger RNA. And by the way, there's ribosomal RNA and transfer RNA that are also being copied, and about 16 other things I'm not telling you about. We're focusing on a very small piece of this picture. So here's the messenger RNA that's been ready to prepared for its travel. Now it's got to travel outside the nucleus. You see that hole right there? This messenger RNA is going to go out that hole, and it's going to come out into the cytoplasm. It's going to be picked up here by two ducks hugging each other. That's what that looks like, isn't it? That's not what it really looks like. Those are called ribosomes, and it's taken through the ribosomes after it migrates. It's taken through the ribosomes and read like a tape through a tape recorder and translated, and then proteins come out the bottom. Every step of that process, ladies and gentlemen, requires proteins. Approximately 50 different specific proteins are required to make that happen. Here's an interesting challenge for an evolutionist. All 50 of those proteins are coded up here in the DNA. So how did this process get started? Because to make a protein, you got to have all this happening. And to make it happen, you need the proteins. It's a problem. But I'm not focusing on that one tonight. I'm just focusing on this process. So, how about it, Mr. Techie Guy? Now I've charged him with getting this ready. So there it is. We're going to do a 3D reenactment of what happens when you build proteins. Okay? And I'm going to be the moderator. And my techie guy is going to stop when I tell him to stop. Right? Robert's ready. Finger. Okay. Please roll the tape. What you see here, ladies and gentlemen, is the DNA, the beautiful helix. Stop. Thank you. Can you see those four letters that they've spread across here? This is the DNA that's wrapped around itself, that contains all the information down inside the nucleus. You remember what I told you, class? Nod your head so I'm thinking you're with me. Okay, let's proceed. Now, what you can see what begins to happen as this thing rotates inside the nucleus. What happens now is, you see this glob stop right there? This glob right here is a glob of proteins, one of which is RNA polymerase. I showed you that on the other picture, that big purple blob. You know it's a lot more complicated than that. I need 6 hours to teach this to you. Because you see all those different colors? Brown, yellow, red, blue. That's a whole glob of all different proteins that all have to work together to let that thing unzip and allow it to be copied. And by the way, this is thrown in free of charge. Have you ever found a zipper that got stuck? I have. That could happen in here too. Did you know there's a very specific protein that keeps that thing stretched so that when it zips back together, it doesn't get stuck? It's incredible. That's another subject. So here's the glob riding along. You know, it rides along the DNA and unzips it and allows it to be copied. And then it zips it back together again. Okay, let's proceed. Now, we're going to go down inside here in just a second and look at what's happening down inside. Look, this is the glob. And down inside, you see what's happening? This is the side that's been exposed. And now here we get one piece at a time, adding the exact mirror image of the information on this DNA as it's being made, and then it's let loose. This is the messenger RNA. Stop! We lost it, but don't go back. That was all happening down inside here. And the messenger RNA is released then as it collects all that information. Okay? Now let's proceed. So here's the messenger RNA. Eventually, you see, all the information's copied. Stop. And here's the messenger RNA now that contains all that information that it transcribed off the DNA. It's now released into the cytoplasm of the nucleus, and it starts migrating. What do you think it takes to help it migrate? Proteins. Now let's continue. Migrate. And it comes to, look, you see those holes right there? Stop. See those holes? Do you think, ladies and gentlemen, that the cell walls of the nuclear membrane wants to let just anything in and out of those holes? Absolutely not. Only certain things are allowed in and out. And guess who guards the gate? Proteins. So you watch. As this messenger RNA comes up to the hole there, go ahead. It approaches one of these holes. And do you see that little circle? Stop right there. You see that circle? That's a protein. And it's guarding that opening. And it only opens up at the command of certain things. And one of them is messenger RNA. So the messenger RNA proceeds. All right, go ahead. Now you see how it's so nicely opening up for the messenger RNA to go through? He said, please come on through. And it proceeds right on through. Keep going. And it comes out the other side. You see? Stop. Okay. Guess what's on the other side of that nuclear membrane? Another protein that also stops it from the other side. So you've got that thing doing this only when necessary. All right, so now we have our messenger RNA outside the nuclear membrane. It's now in the cytoplasm of the cell, and let's proceed. So here it comes along, and here are two pieces of the ribosome, which in that other picture looked like two ducks. Stop right there. And the ribosome closes in on the messenger RNA and begins to read the information off of this code down inside the ribosome. Guess what it takes to make that happen? Proteins. Now, down inside there, let's see if he gives us a picture of that. Keep going. Okay. It's closed in on it now, and it begins to read, and you'll watch. Here's what's happening. Stop right there. You see that three-letter code on the messenger RNA that it picked up off the DNA? That three-letter code tells the cell to go out and grab something that is exactly the mirror image of that and bring in a piece of amino acid right there. And then when it needs reads the next three letters, it says, go get me the next amino acid. And it comes in and hooks them up together. They form a polypeptide bond there, and now you have a two amino acid chain. And then it keeps going. Let's keep going. So here, can you see that? The transfer RNA is bringing in the amino acids, reading the code, and building the protein down there at the bottom. Stop right there. Folks, that is going so slow, I'm about going to sleep up here. Do you know how long it takes to build a protein with 1,000 amino acids in a row? You watch me closely. Here's how fast it is. That was way too slow. So the picture they're showing you here of one and another and another and another, that's ridiculous. So watch them speed it up here. Too slow. Way too slow. Slow. Still too slow. Stop it right there. That's what's going on inside here. At an incredible rate, ladies and gentlemen. Incredible. And out the bottom comes the protein. The information's being read up here. The protein's being built down there. There's a physical distance between the protein and the information. And it's all ameliorated by other proteins and transfer RNA, which is another whole story. As the thing is translated, so it builds proteins. I want to tell you something, class. Henry Ford, with his plants to build cars, never touched this. This is way better than any Henry Ford plant. And it happens all the time at a phenomenal rate. Let's go on. You see the protein coming out the bottom here? And once it's completely done, then it has to be picked up by another protein body. Stop right there. Because you see, a protein is not just a strand of amino acids. It's a strand that's particularly shaped into a three-dimensional structure that is unique for every protein. And if that protein doesn't get enfolded in the specific shape that it needs to have, it won't function. You see, it has primary, secondary, and tertiary geometry that all have to be right. So the protein proceeds over to this object inside the cytoplasm that allows it to form now, watch, into its specific three-dimensional configuration. And when all that process is completed, then and only then is it released into the cytoplasm to go do the work for which it was built. Okay, you can stop in there. I like to pause right there. Did you hear the last word I said? It goes out into the cytoplasm to do the job for which it was built. Most times when you talk about something being built, you talk about a builder. Most of the time when you speak of it having a purposeful end, you speak of somebody that designed it. And I want to say to you, ladies and gentlemen, if you can believe in your heart of hearts that that process we've just described, and we have not told you one-tenth of the story of its complexity, if you can believe that nature produced that by itself without any intelligent guidance whatsoever, I have a bridge I want to talk to you about that I'd like to sell you. But that's exactly what evolutionists believe. I have not seen such faith in all of Israel. Let's go back to our slides now. You know why I'm breathing heavily? Because I know I need to apologize to every living cell for the pitifully inadequate presentation I've just made. I haven't told you one-tenth of what we already know, much less what we don't know. There's a host of things we don't have a clue about yet. We got some hints. But I'll tell you what we discovered. All that I've just told you was already known by the 1970s. I was in college in the 1960s, and I want to tell you what all my teachers told me. They said, Students, you folks who believe in God in this class, you better get over it. Because we are so rapidly uncovering the secrets of life, it won't be very long before we know how to produce life in a test tube, and you still believe in God? And I will tell you, as a young student in college, I didn't know how to handle that. It scared me to death. I thought if I dug into the sciences deeply, I'd lose my faith. And I want to tell you something, young people. Don't you be afraid of the sciences. You dig in there and learn everything you can learn. And what I've experienced over the last 50 years is that the deeper I dig, the more I find that God must have designed this. And I'll tell you what scientists have learned in the last 40 years since the 1970s. They've learned it's so much more complex and magnificent than they ever dreamed, that the opportunities to explain how life evolved is far beyond their reach now, much farther than it was 50 years ago. Because the more we learn, the worse it gets for them. And the better it gets for one who believes in God. But I must tell you, there are always going to be wrinkles along the way that you don't know how to answer. And here's one of them. You see, in the 1970s, and from then on till about 2003, when we mapped the whole human genome, you remember that? That was in your lifetime. We began to discover that only about 5% of the DNA was necessary to produce the proteins that I just told you about. That magnificent story I just told you only takes about 5% of the DNA. And as we began to learn more about the DNA, it sure began to look like there's a lot of junk in there. We began to discover that there were whole sequences of repetitive information just looked like a bunch of junk. And then it looked like there were pieces in there that had been mutated and just left behind, you know, like you break something and don't pick it up and throw it away. And then it looked like there were pseudo-genes in there. A specific one that's been made a big old argument about is humans need vitamin C, right? That's why you need to take your vitamin C. Your body doesn't produce vitamin C. But there's a pseudo-gene in your DNA that looks like maybe you used to produce it, but you don't anymore. And what does an evolutionist do with that? He said, why would a God who supposedly is designing this produce something that's 95% junk? Is that the way your God does? 5% useful, 95% junk. That doesn't look like something designed. And may I say to you, when that started coming along in the 80s and 90s and on up into the 2000s, I didn't know how to answer that. It bothered me because I don't think God would make 95% junk. But here's my answer to you, ladies and gentlemen. There's never been a time in the history of mankind that we knew all the answers. And if you're struggling with something right now that you don't know how to answer from scientific evidence, my advice to you is give it about 25 years. And what you're going to find out is what they thought was an ironclad argument turns out to fall apart the more we learn. And my experience has been the more I learn and the more I dig, the deeper my faith becomes that there had to be a designer behind this. And this one's exactly the same way, though we have yet to discover all the answers. I'll tell you what we're beginning to discover. That system I've described to you is so much more complex than anybody ever dreamed. And I want to give you two books to recommend to you. Signature in the Cell by Stephen Meyer, published in 2011. And The Myth of Junk DNA by Jonathan Wells, also published in late 2011. If you're interested in this subject, you dig into these books and they'll lead you 68 other places where you can investigate more deeply. They're based on strong evidence from the scientific world by people who believe in evolution. And here's what they've discovered. There's more densely concentrated information than we ever dreamed. Because there are multiple messages stored in the same sequence we are learning. There are spliceosomes and exosomes that can take it apart and put it back together in another order. There are codes within codes. There are dual and overlapping messages inside there. You remember that strand of messenger RNA that I showed you on that clip? Do you know what we've learned, ladies and gentlemen? That when it is being matured, you remember those little white pieces that had to be clipped out? Those are called introns. Here's what we're learning. Those introns, which we thought were junk, are able to rearrange that thing so that the same piece of information can build 1,000 different proteins by being guided by some of that junk they thought was useless. And inside of a code, there's a code hidden and buried inside of a code. Now you try to explain that, Mr. Evolutionist. How do you get a code inside of a code? There's a file within folder system to make retrieving, manipulating, and expressing information-rich data more efficient. Look, folks, it's similar to words, sentences, and paragraphs. There are genes and gene folders and superfolders. There is so much information tied up in that DNA, which is all wrapped up around itself. How are you going to find it? It's kind of like finding stuff on my desk. It's because it's got an organized system. And that system is being guided by what they thought was junk. And what we're learning is the rest of that DNA, it appears, contains within it a guidance system for the whole process. I had a professor sitting in my audience one night who got up after I finished and he said, "Now, Professor Payne, what you haven't told this audience is all this stuff you told them about the DNA. The fact is 95% of that DNA is junk, and we know it." And thankfully, by that time, I had discovered a little bit of this, and I was able to say to the professor, "Sir, I think it would be more humble and more appropriate to say maybe we don't know what's being done by the rest of that DNA rather than calling it junk." And the fact is, a lot of that junk we've already uncovered does a lot of things vital to the processes taking place in that cell. Be careful what you call junk. It may come back to bite you. I'll skip over that one. But I'll tell you what, beloved, if we received a message from outer space containing nothing but the genetic code, everybody on earth would say that's designed. If you add on top of that all the things the genetic code does in every living cell at a fantastic rate of building proteins in microseconds, how Dawkins and his ilk can call me ignorant and stupid in the face of this, I would say to him, the magnitude of your faith in what nature can produce is incredible. And the evidence on which it is founded is minimal. I don't have that much faith. I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. The evidence of the natural world does not support that. And in my view, any reasonable person ought to be able to see it in 2012. In fact, is it reasonable to believe in God in this age of enlightenment? I would say it's more reasonable than ever. In fact, I'd go farther than that, and I, with Dr. Behe, would say everywhere we look, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, things look like they're made. Everywhere you look is a loud, clear, piercing cry of design. Why would we not admit the obvious? That there's a designer behind this. I believe God's going to say one day, to so many who refuse to see, "You remind me of those in the days of Isaiah who seeing could not see and hearing could not hear, lest they be converted." What else could I have done for you to open up the abundance of evidence in the natural world? I hope everybody in this audience has a small appreciation, more than you had before, of God's testimony in his other book. And I thank you, class. You've paid close attention. You get an A for attention tonight on a subject that's not exactly close to your heart, probably. But it is close to your heart. It's in your heart. It's going on every second. And I close tonight, then, since we're in this assembly, with this reference to John, the 14th chapter, from Jesus Christ our Lord. He said in that famous passage, "You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also." And then he was asked, "We don't know the way." And that's when Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me." You want to come to God tonight? You've come to believe in him? Jesus said, if you believe in God, you need to believe in me also. Now, you're not going to learn about Jesus from the natural world. You're going to have to go to this book. I hope you do. And I hope when you dig into it and find out what God did for us who are sinners, even to the sacrificing of his own son for our sake, that you'll fall in love with this God who made us and decide to give your life to him. And here's what Jesus said. You want to come to God? You have to come through me. You believe with all your heart Jesus Christ is the Son of God? He said, you come and be baptized for the remission of your sins and rise to walk a new life given over to me. I hope there's someone even tonight ready to do that. Won't you come while we stand and as we sing?